Leia Thompson wrote the cover story for a recent edition of the Philadelphia City Paper titled The Cash Machine. In it, he writes about something called civil asset forfeiture. That's a state law that allows the police to confiscate personal property, including cash, belonging to criminal suspects for possible use in a trial. According to Thompson's investigation, people found innocent of a crime have had their money seized and have had a difficult, even impossible time getting it back from the district attorney's office. He also raises questions about how the confiscated money, amounting to millions of dollars a year, is spent. We asked a representative from the DA's office to join us and were told that they were not able to supply us with a guest, but I'm happy to say that Isaiah Thompson is with us, and he recently joined the Philadelphia Public Interest Information Network as a writer and investigative reporter. He worked for the Philadelphia City Paper as a reporter and columnist for a number of years, and his story was funded in part by a grant from the Fund for Investigative Journalism. And Isaiah, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Oh, it's great to be back. Thanks.
Let me begin where your report begins, and this is with a man named Dwayne Marks. He got stopped by the police. What happened?
Yeah, Dwayne Marks is a black man in his late 30s who was stopped by the police while he was driving on Broad Street near Temple. And according to his account, the police asked if they could search his vehicle, and he said, yeah, sure. And his vehicle was searched, and the police found $6,000, just over $6,000 inside the car. So Mr. Marks was taken down to the station, and his car was further searched. He said they brought out a drug-sniffing dog. But there was no drugs in the car, and he was let go. There are no charges. That detail I was certainly able to confirm. No criminal charges were brought against him, but his money was taken at the time, and he was given a property receipt for that money. And he was notified about a month later. He received a letter from the district attorney's office saying, we're moving to seize your money by this process that you described in your introduction. If you want to keep it, you need to show up in court.
And why did he even have $6,000 in cash in his car?
He said he always carries a lot of cash. He owns a lot of rental properties. He deals in cash a lot. I've talked to other people. There are other people in the story who had far smaller amounts of money seized in similar circumstances and in different circumstances, but as little as $80 or $100 at times.
But as I said in the intro, and as you write in the piece, according to state law, police are allowed, if I guess they have a criminal suspect, they are allowed to take some of their property. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. And the civil asset forfeiture part of this, I'm trying to explain this as succinctly as possible here. But yeah, it has much more to do with the district attorney's office than the police. The police most of the cases we're talking about are arrests, unlike Mr. Marks's case, and most of them involve alleged drug activity. So the police will confiscate this money. The forfeiture part is that the district attorney is empowered under state law, mostly under state drug laws, to seize that money because the money itself, according to this legal construction, is criminal money. It's tied to crime. But the process in which they seize it is a civil process, not a criminal process. And one of the things that I learned is that in Philadelphia, like in many places in the United States, these two processes are completely separate, such that whether or not someone is ever convicted in a criminal process has little bearing on whether they lose this money in the civil process.
This is a system or a process that has been going on for a number of years now. This is not new.
That's right. This program has been going on in Philadelphia for decades, which I was amazed to find how long it's been going, how much revenue it's generated for the district attorney's office and the police department. They share this money once it's successfully forfeited. I was surprised to see almost nothing had ever been written about this or really made public about it.
Well, you say even recently about $6 million a year. Is that pretty much how much has been brought in then?
That's right. This program brings in roughly, it goes up and down, and I looked at a number of years. But yeah, you're looking at an average $6 million a year. And I should say that there are two processes involved here. I wrote about one of them for this piece, which is mostly cash,
right,
currency that is seized, as well as some vehicles and other things. There's a separate process in which the DA goes after properties that are nuisance properties or you know, a crack house, something like that. That represents about maybe 1.5 million of that figure, but the bulk of that money is brought in through cash seizures, about 4.5 million.
How does Philadelphia compare to Pittsburgh, another city that you looked at that obviously operates under the same law?
Yeah, that I thought this was a very interesting comparison. Allegheny County has its own district attorney, of course, and they're operating under the same state laws that we are here in Philadelphia. But they pursue only a couple hundred, actually even less, they have pursued only a couple hundred of these cases in the last few years. And at first I just couldn't understand that. Because they also bring in substantial revenue through this program. But it turns out that the reason is that they will also pursue money that is seized, but they'll do it at the end of the criminal process. They'll do it mostly via the criminal process, which means that if someone is found not guilty or the charges are withdrawn or whatever, in general, their money is returned to them. In Philadelphia, that is not the case.
And is that because of the fact that we're talking about civil forfeiture, but talking about a criminal case? You've got this disconnect between these two legal systems?
Right. I mean, in theory, they're completely separate processes. But in reality, they're very much connected. Someone is arrested on the street, let's say, and usually they're charged with a crime. And the money that was seized in that arrest. So, you know, there's a logical connection there.
Comparing again Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, you said in the year 2011 there were 6,560 cases pursued by the DA's office.
Oh, gosh. Yes, that is right.
From that, so the police department gets the money, I guess. They're the ones that seize the money, but how does it end up in the DA's office?
Yeah, well, so police will seize the money in an arrest. A property receipt will be issued. And then what the district attorney will do here is they go through those property receipts in what I described in my piece as kind of a civil forfeiture assembly line, just churning out. And this is only a few people. There are only two people who are dedicated to handle these thousands and thousands of cases a year, two assistant district attorneys, I should say. So they'll go through these property receipts, and anything that sort of meets certain loose criteria, there was alleged drug activity, something like that, they will type into some kind of program and put into a form letter, and that becomes a lawsuit. And there were 6,500 of these cases generated in 2011. There were 8,000 some in 2010. It's a massive, massive system.
If someone is innocent, like the gentleman we began with, Dwayne Marks, how do they get their money back?
Well, that's a very interesting question. In his case, because so much money was at stake, that's actually quite unusual.
Right.
I found that the usual amount that's seized is only a few hundred dollars. In Mr. Marks' case, he hired an attorney, and his attorney called him up, and his attorney's first advice was, look, the DA is willing to settle with you, so I think you should take the settlement. And what that meant was the DA essentially had said, how's about you keep half and we keep half and we call it a day? And Mr. Marks made a decision that he figured, well, I may be paying this lawyer. His attorney also told him it could take as long as 2 years to get his money back. And he said, well, I'll cut my losses.
So he got three and the DA's office got three?
That's right.
You described, this is courtroom 478 in City Hall. You have spent some time outside this courtroom, and this is where these cases are, heard?
Yeah. 478 is a very interesting place. I've spent a lot of time inside and outside that courtroom. That's the entry point. So for all these cases, the first thing, a respondent, it's not a defendant because they're not being charged with the crime. They're just sort of responding to defend their money, in a sense. Or defend their property, I should say. But the first thing they need to do is show up at that room. And if they don't show up, they lose on the first case listing. That is what happens to about 85% of these cases.
And why don't people show up?
You know, I still don't totally understand, but I think it's a few reasons. One reason is I'm sure that in a lot of these cases, the money probably is ill-gotten. I'm sure that's the case in many, if not most, of these cases.
Even if they are not charged with a crime or found guilty of a crime?
Well, most of these people are charged with a crime, and most of those people will be found guilty of the crime. What I discovered was that that's not true for everybody. There are roughly from what I've from I had to take random samples, you're looking at maybe 15 to 20% of the people charged will wind up not being found guilty. Now, that might be that the district attorney withdrew charges, or it might be they went to trial and were found not guilty. It could be one of a few things. The majority of, and then there's a much smaller proportion, but a persistent proportion, who were never charged with any crime.
And these are the people then going to courtroom 478 to try to get their money back, or some of the people that
some of them, yeah. And, you know, I mean, but another reason that people don't show up is that it may not be worth it. I mean, if you had $100 seized, which I've seen in many cases, I've seen $80. You know, if you're a working person, even showing up to that one court listing might be a losing proposition. Hiring an attorney is certainly out of the question for an amount of money that small. And that is, you know, the mean sum that I saw in my figures was around $200-some.
Wow. But adding up to about $6 million a year.
That's right.
Where does that money go? How is it spent? Who decides?
Well, I can only answer the question vaguely because the district attorney declined to give me any details about how it's spent. I was able to get documents that are submitted to the state attorney general's office that spell out in very general terms how the money is spent. It is spent, it is shared with the Philadelphia Police Force. They told me some specifics. They spend it on basically everyday drug policing. They spend it on crime equipment. They spend it on police overtime. They spend it on buy money and drug busts. What proportion goes to them, what proportion the district attorney keeps, how the district attorney uses that money, I don't know because they wouldn't tell me. I filed a right-to-know request, and that was rejected, and I'm hoping to still get that information at some point.
We've been focusing on Philadelphia, but is this a national story? Are others looking at other district attorneys' offices?
Yeah, very much so. This is happening, and I should be clear on that. This happens all over the United States. Most states have some sort of law that permits civil forfeiture. Some states have more protections for people. Some have less. There's a great report by the Institute for Justice, which is a libertarian civil liberties union, which kind of shows you the wide spectrum of people who are interested in this issue that American Civil Liberties Union is also interested in. And you've got people at different ends of the political spectrum. This happens all over the place. What was interesting about Philadelphia to me is that I haven't seen anything remotely like it anywhere else in the country in terms of its the number of cases that are filed and the smallness of those cases in terms of what the district attorney is actually pursuing.
The couple $100 here and there.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, and originally these laws were conceived. Oh, we're taking a break.
Isaiah Thompson has been a guest on Radio Times before, and he knows that when you hear that song, we are going to take a break. And we're also going to get back to our conversation with him. He wrote a piece for the Philadelphia City Paper recently called The Cash Machine, and we are talking about his findings. And we have Lou Rulli waiting in the wings. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. As part of a citywide celebration of Frank Furness on the anniversary of his death, PAFA is exhibiting architectural drawings of the Furness-designed historic landmark building. On view through December 30th, these rare drawings document the evolution of this historical building. More information online at pafa.org or by phone at 215-972-7600.
Yuck, they're greasy.
I know, Michael said. They're not as good as my mom's.
A fourth grader fries his own latkes and cooks up a small miracle. And an uncertain young life is mysteriously redirected. I'm Susan Stamberg. Join me and Murray Horowitz for the 2012 edition of Hanukkah Lights from NPR.
Monday night at 10 on WHYY.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Have you been feeling depressed, anxious? The Integrative Medicine and Depression Research Unit at Penn Medicine is studying the causes and treatment of mood disorders. You may be eligible to participate in a research study looking at the effects of natural supplements to treat the symptoms of depression or anxiety. Initial evaluations determine eligibility for treatment. To learn more about Penn Medicine's Integrative Medicine and Depression Research Unit, 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Isaiah Thompson about a piece that ran, in fact, it was the cover story of the Philadelphia City Paper just a week or so ago called The Cash Machine, about the alleged use and misuse of something called civil asset forfeiture. And Isaiah Thompson now is with the Philadelphia Public Interest Information Network as a writer and investigative reporter. Joining us now is Lou Rulli, and he's a practice professor of law and clinical director at the University of Pennsylvania School of Law. Before joining the Penn Law faculty, he was executive director of the Community Legal Services here in Philadelphia. And Lou Rulli, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be with you this morning.
So how is the civil forfeiture law supposed to work? You've been listening to Isaiah as he's been describing his piece.
I have, and I think his article, by the way, has brought to light a substantial problem that is largely hidden from public view, but which affects a substantial number of Philadelphians. Essentially, what happened in the 70s and the 80s, Congress and many of the states extended civil forfeiture laws to apply to drug trafficking, with the idea that if they could get the tools of the trade and have that forfeited to the government through civil proceedings, they could help to win the war against drugs. And the theory, of course, is that against large traffickers, to grab their yachts or grab the property that really is the ill-gotten gains could make some sense. But when used aggressively against small individuals, small amounts, people who have never been charged with a crime, people who may have been charged with a crime but never convicted of a crime, it raises all kinds of problems. And I think what the article attempts to do is show what some of those problems are.
But do you see this as a misuse of the law, a misreading of the law?
No, certainly the district attorney's office is empowered by state law to bring civil forfeiture proceedings, to seize property, they have the right to do that. But the question is whether they should do that. They have a number of tools at their disposal. One is criminal forfeiture, one is civil forfeiture. Criminal forfeiture is used at the end of a criminal proceeding when someone is found guilty of the crime, and then it makes sense to seize and forfeit the property that was part of or facilitated that crime. But in a civil proceeding, that's not necessarily the case. And therefore, individuals who have not committed a crime, or have not even been charged, are at risk for losing their property in a civil proceeding where there are lower burdens, less safeguards for property owners. And so that's raised real questions. And particularly, that's what's led to, I think, this high default rate that's been described here. And that's been a problem not only in Philadelphia, but across the nation. In fact, Congress studied this problem and instituted substantial reforms in the federal civil asset forfeiture law in 2000 because it was so concerned that studies showed that at least 80% are defaulting, and so they're not showing up. And I think you have some of the reasons there. If there's $200 at issue, it's going to be more expensive to fight the district attorney's office to get that money back than it is to go after it. So, or they have to miss work repeatedly, coming back and forth to court many times. And if you're poor, you don't even have the ability to pay for counsel. And frankly, there is just a scarcity of resources available to provide counsel in those situations.
Did you want to add something, Isaiah?
Hi, Professor.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And I should say the professor is quoted in Isaiah's piece.
That's right, yeah. I've seen cases. If you look at the cases in which people do fight these proceedings, there are cases in which people have been required to show up to court 10, 11, 12 times even. That's not everybody, of course, but that certainly happens. The process can drag out.
Well, let me ask you something that I asked Isaiah, and then I think it cries out to be asked because of the story that he wrote. What recourse, then, does an innocent person have? I mean, a person who did not commit a crime but had, let's say, some cash forfeited.
Well, hopefully, they get counsel. I mean, let me just say on that, when Congress instituted reforms on the federal level, it provided for a right to counsel for indigent property owners whose primary home was at stake in this situation. Remember, we're not just talking about cash, although it's a big part of what we're talking about. We are also talking about cars and people's homes, and they're all at risk in civil forfeiture. I think one of the major problems is that these kinds of laws create a pecuniary or financial interest in the district attorney's office to forfeit property because they get the direct proceeds of the forfeited money. And that's been one of the major criticisms across the country about these kinds of laws, that district attorney's office prosecuting these are getting the direct benefits when they are able to forfeit property. I mean, we have a good DA in the city. We have a good district attorney's office. I mean, this is an opportunity to really look at these policies and to make substantial reforms in our system.
Go ahead, Isaiah.
And I was just going to say that I think the professor also made a good point earlier, which is that this is not necessarily a misuse of the law, because the law allows the district attorney's office to do exactly this. And in repeated conversations with the DA's office, that was one of the main points they made to me. They said, look, we are empowered to do this. We have a mandate under state law to do this, and we're going ahead. So it is a question more of priorities than of misuse of law.
But as you were saying, Lou, this was it became law because the I guess district attorneys and states wanted to go after big drug dealing kingpins.
That's right. And unfortunately, it's the aggressive enforcement that we see here in Philadelphia and in some other places around the country really have taken this and have really accentuated the abuses that are possible in these very harsh and sweeping civil asset forfeiture laws. I might add there's one other, I think, very important issue here, and that is that these laws have a disproportionate impact on minorities, particularly our African-American and Hispanic citizens in Philadelphia are more at risk to have their property taken and often don't have the resources to fight back.
Just a couple minutes before we have to say goodbye, but Isaiah, from your investigation, what kind of reforms do you see as possible to fix what you uncovered?
Well, it depends what you think the problem is. It depends if you think there is a problem. You know, the district attorney and I did not always see eye to eye on that fundamental question in our conversations. But if you think that it's a problem that people can lose property without being proven guilty of a crime or even charged with a crime, then, you know, it seems to me that if that's a problem, Allegheny County would be an example of instituting a system that has a safeguard, that has a check, which is that if you're found innocent, you will have your property returned. And, you know, I think that solves that problem if you accept that it is a problem.
But do you think there should be more oversight of the money that does come into the office?
I think that's a very interesting question. It is very unusual to have an amount of money that size with that little oversight by any other entity. The city doesn't seem to know how it's spent. The city controller doesn't seem to know how it's spent. I think that's problematic because, as the professor pointed out, there are potential cross incentives here. There is not an agency in the world that doesn't notice $6 million in revenue coming in every year. And I think that it should be looked into how that money is spent.
Have you heard from anyone from City Hall, for instance, or even the mayor's office on this?
No, not really. You know, I called them, and they sort of shrugged. They didn't know about it. This fund hasn't really been examined in a long time.
And Lou, final question to you. What kind of reforms do you think are necessary?
Well, on the last point, I think most critics of civil asset forfeiture laws say that the money, if it's going to be forfeited, it ought to go to the Treasury. It should not go to the law enforcement agency that is responsible for prosecuting. In that way, we have transparency, we have accountability, and we have public view of how that money is spent. I do think that criminal forfeiture over civil forfeiture should be used, and we have to simplify the process and make it easier, less expensive. We have to have access to counsel, so innocent citizens can retain their property.
Well, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Lou Rulli, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And he's a practice professor of law and clinical director at the University of Pennsylvania School of Law. And Isaiah Thompson, as always, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
As always, thank you.
And you're very welcome. And you can read his story in the Philadelphia City Paper, the November 29th cover story called The Cash Machine, how the Philadelphia DA seizes millions in alleged crime money, whether there's been a crime or not. And Isaiah now has joined the Philadelphia Public Interest Information Network. And I should also add that we did invite someone from the district attorney's office to join us, and they were unable to provide a guest. Well, now we want to turn our attention to Philadelphia Traffic Court. An investigation by former Assistant District Attorney William Chadwick uncovered a two-track system that allowed the politically connected to avoid paying fines, which meant they didn't get points or lose their license or have insurance increases. Craig McCoy broke this story for the Philadelphia Inquirer and joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. He's been an investigative reporter at the Inquirer for about 15 years, and he's won numerous awards over the decades exposing injustice and corruption in Philadelphia. And Craig, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's good to be here.
So what does traffic court do?
Well, that's a really good question, actually, because the public is quite confused. Traffic court handles moving violations that are given drivers by police. And these are the ones that are quite worrisome because they can involve trigger insurance surcharges, points that can get you, that can generate fines and also ultimately get your license suspended or pulled. Traffic court is a different entity from the Philadelphia Parking Authority, which is a bigger enterprise that handles essentially parking tickets and that are given out by the uniform representatives of the authority. And when you appeal a parking ticket, you do not go to the to traffic court. You go to a different facility, which is actually nearby, that's has a awful bureaucratic name, like I think it's called the Bureau of Administrative Adjustment. And that's actually, not to get into the weeds, but that's actually a subset of the city finance department.
Okay, just to lay out the complicated landscape here. This investigation, though, by former ADA William Chadwick did look into traffic court. Actually, sounds like in response to an FBI investigation of about a year and a half ago.
That's right. It was triggered when the news broke publicly that the FBI had raided both traffic court offices, chambers of judges, as well as their homes, their home offices, and homes of top administrators in the court.
And what this report found, there was something called special consideration. I guess we might think of it as ticket fixing, but it was called special consideration in the court.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a Casablanca moment. I mean, I can't say that anyone was terribly shocked to hear that ticket fixing continues in Philadelphia. But in the wake of the FBI report, Chief Justice Castile, who is everyone, as people may know, is a former is a Philadelphian and a former Philadelphia DA, decided to kind of get ahead of this, or at least get his arms around it, and he appointed William Chadwick, a former Inspector General for the state, and also a former acting DA in Philadelphia. To look into it on a parallel track to the FBI. And the result was the report that came out about 2 weeks ago.
And the report focused in on a number of these, I guess, judges, but it also talked about the fact that this seemed like business as usual at the traffic court, the fact that someone with political connections would come in and want to have their ticket fixed.
Yeah, I mean, it was really comprehensive and kind of stunningly so, because I think more than 20 staffers and four different judges all acknowledged that tickets fixing, quote-unquote, special consideration was widespread. It was just endemic for anyone with political juice could make a call in. And, of course, again, unsurprisingly, the staff and family members of employees and judges could get their tickets fixed.
And we're talking about a patronage-heavy court?
Yeah, although it's a little nuanced and complicated. From what I'm told, the judges are elected, and in this democratic city, the judges are democratic and, of course, answerable to the Democratic City Committee. But most of the workforce is Republican selected. So it's kind of a bifurcated patronage outfit.
I'm quoting here from the Pennsylvania Constitution, which was in Chadwick's report. A magisterial district judges shall not allow their family, social, or other relationships to influence their judicial conduct or judgment. They shall not lend the prestige of their office to advance the private interests of others, and going on from there. I mean, if what is alleged is true, that's against the Pennsylvania Constitution.
Right, and you know, it's flatly at a minimum against the rules of the court, and you know, there's many more shoes to drop, a centipede of shoes to drop in this thing, but one of them could be a disciplinary action by the court and the also the disciplinary body for judges called the Board of Judicial Conduct. That's completely apart from what are widely expected to be a range of federal criminal indictments that we expect to break this month or next.
You wrote about, and Chadwick wrote about, or I guess interviewed a woman named Christine Solomon. What do we need to know about her?
Christine Solomon is one of the judges. You don't have to be a lawyer to be a traffic court judge, incidentally, and none of them are lawyers. And that's true, by the way, across Pennsylvania for all. They're the equivalent, for what it's worth, of district justices in the suburbs. And none of those people have to be attorneys, and many are not. And they're actually a powerful lobby. They're lucrative jobs and political jobs. And, you know, the case they make is that they're, quote, unquote, a people's court. And they say it's actually a virtue that you know, it's
it
open,
doesn't have
open
judges
to lay
and lawyers.
Persons. Right. So anyway, Ms. Solomon was a judge, elected judge. There is a test you have to take to before you can begin serving, and she failed that and had to take it again before she could begin serving as a judge. When Chadwick's people came in, she was they had to, as I understand it, well, the report says that they had to interview her three times. Mm-hmm. And in the first interview, she said she was unfamiliar with the term ticket fixing. They really didn't know what they were talking about. At the second interview, she was warned that that she had to cooperate and speak truthfully or at risk of being disciplined by the Supreme Court. And then, according to the report, she said she wasn't feeling well and cut off that interview, although the report notes she went on to serve on the court that day. Finally, in the third interview, she conceded that the tickets were fixed, but also said she didn't want to talk about it. She didn't want to incriminate others and said, look, it's just politics.
Another judge, Warren Hoagland, told by Judge DeAngelis, this is Philadelphia. This is how we do things in Philadelphia.
Yeah, I mean, he was she, according to the report, you know, gave him the rules of the road when he came in and said, you know, we do things differently here. He is a DJ in Bucks County, but he also served as a as an appointed judge in Philadelphia. And he was one of the more forthright judges and really, again, said that the practice was widespread.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Now, we are talking about a reporter investigation done by former ADA William Chadwick, looking into Philadelphia traffic court, uncovering what he described as a two-track system allowing the politically connected to avoid paying fines, and a system that certainly advantaged those with political connections. Craig McCoy broke this story for the Philadelphia Inquirer, where he's been investigative reporter at the paper for about 15 years. Lynn Marks is waiting in the wings, and we do want to open up the phones at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Handel's inspiring Messiah has become as integral to the American holiday season as Dickens' A Christmas Carol or the film It's a Wonderful Life. The Philadelphia Orchestra performing Handel's Messiah. Tickets at 215-893-1999 or online. Sunday, December 23rd at 2 p.m., one performance only at the Kimmel Center. The Philadelphia Orchestra presents Handel's Messiah.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. In the age of Twitter and iPhone cameras, when everyone can snap a picture, which ones to publish? The ethics of news photography. Also, epic, LOL, literally, words you'd like to leave behind at year's end. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Thomas Jefferson University Hospital joins you in supporting WHYY. Jefferson Hospital for Neuroscience is dedicated to the care and treatment of patients with aneurysms, acute strokes, AVMs, and brain tumors. Employing the latest in non-invasive technologies, including endovascular coiling, interventional stroke therapies, gamma knife, and shaped beam surgery. To schedule an appointment or for information, 1-800-JEFF-NOW or jeffersonhospital.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. We're talking about an investigation into Philadelphia traffic court with Craig McCoy, investigative reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer. And joining us by phone is Lynn Marks, and she's executive director of Pennsylvanians for Modern Courts. That's a statewide nonprofit, nonpartisan organization working to reform Pennsylvania's courts. And Lynn Marks, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Nice to be there. Nice. I really want to commend Craig McCoy and the Inquirer and Karen Helen of the Inquirer, too, for just really being on top of this story.
And why is this story so important, Lynn?
Well, you know, it's important because, well, first of all, traffic court is part of our whole system of justice. But, I mean, it's one thing that's interesting is that Craig earlier called it how it's often called a people's court.
Yes.
It's also technically, you know, designated as a minor court. But it doesn't mean it's less important than other courts. And in fact, the vast majority of people who go to court, you know, go to these people's courts, the traffic court or municipal court, and I'm sure many of the listeners have been there. So, you know, even though it's minor, it's even minor in terms of the seriousness of the cases. In some ways, it's even more important that, you know, the business of these courts be conducted in a fair, transparent, and impartial manner, because this is where people interact most with judges. I often think of the analogy of a bank that, you know, when people go into a bank, they interact with a bank teller, and what they think of that teller is what they're going to think of the whole bank.
Sure.
They don't usually meet the bank president. You know, and in court, you know, we don't usually meet someone who's on the state Supreme Court or the federal, you know, Supreme Court. You know, we meet somebody who's in traffic court. And so what you think of a judge, a traffic court judge, and what you read about in one of these reports, you know, is what you're going to think of the whole justice system. And we're very concerned that people have confidence in the court system, that the whole purpose of it is to, you know, is to give people a fair shake, and people to feel like they're getting a fair shake when they're in a dispute or involved in a case, criminal or civil.
Craig,
Lynn's absolutely right. And, you know, the numbers are staggering. The court handles about 80,000 cases a year. That's four times the criminal caseload of common police court and municipal court. So, I mean, this is the point of contact for ordinary people with the courts, with the judicial system.
Let me quote something from Chadwick's report. Data analysis established an acquittal rate of 85% for traffic court employees and their families, compared with an acquittal rate of 26% for the public at large, a difference of 327%. But underscoring, I think, what Lynn Marks was saying, Craig, which is people go to court expecting, hoping for some kind of fair and equal justice.
Well, in a report that was full of cynical remarks, the most cynical by far was an unnamed employee of the court who said, look, people should know that, you know, it's on them if they don't realize they need to make a call to get their ticket fixed. And it's, you know, this person said, I have no sympathy for them. They should know this is how the system is rigged.
But Lynn,
you know, you hear something like that and you say, my gosh, am I a sucker for paying my ticket? I mean, that's not what we want out of a system, you know, the fact that so many people, you know, could get special treatment, or, you know, it makes you think like, well, that's what I'm supposed to do.
Mm. But do you think, Lynn, and this might be getting ahead of ourselves because we're talking about a study that was done and no one has been found guilty yet, or certainly guilty per se, but do you think, Lynn, it's time to look at traffic court and to think about maybe bringing in lawyers or bringing in judges instead of sort of moving away from this people's court idea, or ethics training, that kind of thing? That's to you, Lynn.
Well, there are judges, and municipal court is also known as a people's court, and those have to be lawyers. Yes, we think that the traffic court judges should be lawyers. I mean, at least they have a license at stake. if they violate conduct rules, although there are conduct rules for the traffic court judges. But that's not the be-all and the end-all. Mm-hmm. I mean, as we know, there are a lot of judges who are law-trained who get involved with judicial misconduct. You know, not that many, but that certainly happens. So I think that's one of a host of reforms that should happen. But not the be-all and the end-all.
Craig, let me ask you about something again in this Chadwick report about a Supreme Court judge, Seamus McCaffrey. His wife apparently drove the wrong way down the street and got a ticket. What did this report say about how that was handled?
Yeah, well, this would be the most high-profile person that was touched upon in the report. It documented that the wife of Chief Justice Seamus McCaffrey was ticketed for driving the wrong way on Market Street near her office. And it established that on the day of her trial, there were a flurry of phone calls between her husband, the justice, and a fellow named in the report who was the director of operations for traffic court. His name was William Hurd. And Hurd was one of the people whose home was raided by the FBI some months after this incident, and he later quit the court. And the report identifies Hurd as sort of, they actually call him the clearinghouse for requests to fix tickets, that it was so chaotic in the court that they actually designated someone to serve as sort of the central place to channel requests for fixes. And in any event, the judge we discussed earlier from Bucks County, Judge Hoagland, dismissed the ticket against Seamus's wife. And so the report basically suggests that justice arranged for the ticket to be fixed. Now, they interviewed him, and he said not at all, that his concern was actually for the propriety of the court, and that he was requesting that an out of Philadelphia judge hear the case, since he's a political power in Philadelphia, and that fewer questions would be raised if it was an out of county judge. And so we have these, you know, these competing explanations of what happened.
What's going to happen after? I mean, the Chadwick report, as you wrote about it in the paper, what happens next? And then we'll get to some callers. And I want to squeeze in family court if we could as well, but go ahead.
Well, what's a little remarkable, I mean, it's all, we're not quite sure what, you know, as I said, what the fallout's going to be. The Supreme Court has really been silent about it since the report came out. But what we are hearing is that there seems to be anger, at least on the part of some of the justices on the court, that the report was released at all.
Does that surprise you, Lynn? Concern you?
That it was released?
No, that people on the court are upset or even angry that it was released.
Well, you know, as a Pennsylvanians for Modern Courts is a good government organization, and we believe that it's important when there have been reports that a lot of public money goes toward, that the people should be able to see the reports, and that has to do not just with traffic court. You know, but for reports that have been done that Craig has followed for the, right, say, the Philadelphia criminal courts, and there was research done for a family court investigation. So I think it's very important for these reports to come out and see the light of day, because I think it's important not just what do we, you know, not just what happened, but I think we as a government reform group are particularly interested in what are the lessons learned from various problems, and then how do we move forward to avoid these kinds of problems in the future? You know, what kind of structural reforms might be needed? You know, process reforms? Do laws have to be changed? Does the Constitution have to be amended? Is it just some bad actors? I think it definitely should have been released.
Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We have Mark joining us from Gulf Mills. And Mark, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
This is a great program, Marty and Craig. I mean, kudos to you.
And Lynn Marks.
Absolutely phenomenal report. And I am so frustrated with the traffic court, I refuse to shop in the city of Philadelphia, even though I love our city.
Why? Because of traffic court?
I can't stand the corruption. What's that?
Because of traffic? You don't shop in Philly because of traffic court?
Yeah. The parking is such a nightmare. Reading signs, it's just a hassle if you get a ticket. And here you have, you know, the insiders with the revolving door. And you go into the traffic court and you see all these poor people, you know, with their cars impounded and losing their day's pay, all for this absolute nonsense of fundraising for the city of Philadelphia.
Well, Mark, let me just, and actually Craig said this at the very beginning, that the parking authority is different from the traffic court. Mark, Craig, you want to say
Mark,
something?
Yeah, Mark, I understand your annoyance.
Traffic, same thing.
It isn't.
They're different agencies oversee driving violations, which are handed out by police versus parking. Now, with that said, the parking tickets have been infected with corruption as well, and there were a wave of indictments 10 years ago in which bribes were being paid to make sure that parking tickets, particularly by taxi companies, would be deep sixed. But right now, Mark, the scandal involves moving violations,
right.
Driving, not parking.
Not parking. Let me see what Lewis
another
said.
Thing that,
yeah, go ahead, Lynn. I'm sorry, go
yeah,
ahead.
Yeah, another thing that Mark mentioned, I think, was something about fundraising for the city, where in some ways, I mean, I think unfortunately, it's just the opposite. When tickets either are fixed, either whether they're, you know, they're thrown out or the severity of it is decreased, it ends up being a loss of revenue for the city because, you know, as I say, fines are improperly waived or, you know, decreased. So, you know, not only should we be concerned about there not being equal justice, you know, to everybody, but that, you know, we're ultimately losing money from it at a time when the city and every, you know, cities,
sure.
You know, governments and all of us need more money.
But what I hear, Craig, in Mark's call is just, you know, more ammunition to use against the city as a corrupt and contented place.
Well, right. And as we're saying, the thing about both the parking authority and traffic court is these are the courts that really touch upon ordinary people's lives. These are not people who are sort of, you know, maybe hung up in the criminal class. Mm-hmm. This is just the ordinarily going about your business or trying to enjoy the city or simply drive. So that's why I think it's so emotional.
Let me get Lewis from Philadelphia to join us. Lewis, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi.
How you doing?
Good.
Thank you for giving me the time.
Sure. Go ahead.
I'm excited about the opportunity to talk about traffic court because one of the grounding suggestions that was made by one of your speakers about how do we begin to fix it or identify how to strategically go about doing a better job with picking out traffic court judges. I, for one, ran for office for traffic court judge. One of the things that I was amazed at is that nobody, I mean, I presented all my information on the website. I did extensive traveling, and I made it as an independent candidate. What happened that I saw is that there's no transparency in the process of identifying who is running, what their background they are, and who is particularly backing them.
Well,
and, you know, and why are they running? Are they interested or were they handpicked to be a pawn for just what you're talking about, the corruption?
Well, Lewis,
if a person just goes and get the background of it.
Well, I appreciate the call, and actually it's interesting to hear Lynn Marks from someone who ran for this particular office and has concerns about the lack of transparency. Your thoughts, Lynn?
Yeah, I agree with what you're saying, Lewis. I mean, one of the problems with electing traffic court judge and indeed electing other judges in Pennsylvania is too often judges aren't chosen based on their qualifications and experience.
Whoops, I think we lost her somehow. That was Lynn Marks, and we lost her concern, Craig, some of these traffic court judges don't really have the kind of qualifications.
Well, right, and this is precisely, and Lewis, he's right on target. I mean, this is precisely the kind of to say the least, low profile, low interest kind of political post that by default will really be controlled by the Democratic Party through its its selection of a party backed candidate.
I hate to do this because we're about a minute to go, but is there a short synopsis of what has happened with Family Court in Philadelphia?
Yeah, it's hard to keep our scandals separate. The news there was that your listeners may recall that the effort to build a new $180 million Family Court building at 15th and Arch exploded into scandal when it turned out that the guy who had been hired by the Supreme Court to find a site had also had merged as a part owner of, or a part developer of the site. And Chief Justice Castile had a lawsuit filed over that, and the news on that front is that the man's old law firm and the insurance agreed to settle the suit by paying the court's $4 million. The lawyer in question, however, claims that he was vindicated because he didn't have to put any money up himself.
Mm. Lynn, 20 seconds before we have to say goodbye. Any thoughts about Family Court?
Well, since we're short on time, I'm not going to look back right this second, and to look forward in that I've passed by the building. It's going up. It's going to be exciting because the families and children really need an efficient, modern, transparent court. The ones we have now are just not good enough for the people of Philadelphia, and I think that we should look forward to having a new important building.
Well, Lynn Marks, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times. Executive Director of Pennsylvanians for Modern Courts, Craig McCoy, thank you for joining us as well.
You're welcome.
An investigative reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour, but stay with us. We'll be right back. And coming up next, in light of the more than half a billion dollars